Thousands of people chose to drive rather than fly the year following the September 11th attacks. And during that time, 1,595 more people died in automobile accidents than had the year before, while not one person died on a commercial airline flight. Most of us would regard those 1,595 deaths as unfortunate, but routine traffic fatalities. But science writer Daniel Gardner looks at them differently. To him, those deaths were the result of fear, and he looks at the reasons some things scare us more than they should in a book called The Science of Fear, published by Dutton. I'm very pleased it has brought Daniel Gardner to the show today. Hello.
Good afternoon.
You have written about the images on TV of the airplanes slamming into the World Trade Center towers, which were repeated over and over for weeks. How large a role do you think those images played in people's decisions to drive rather than to fly?
Oh, it was immense. It was immense. The core of my book lies in cognitive and social psychology and how we make decisions about anything, including decisions about what we should worry about and what we shouldn't worry about. And if you look at what psychologists have discovered about those processes, and then you compare it to the events of 9/11, and in particular those images, you realize that that event, it's almost inconceivable that there could be another event that could be more compelling, more frightening, more unsettling than that event.
And they remained ingrained in people's brains for a long time.
They're absolutely vivid images. In fact, if I merely say the word terrorism, I have no doubt that those images are going to surface in your mind.
But is it because they were repeated so many times, or was it because they were so shocking? After all, car crashes are also shocking to look at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's everything, of course. It was everything about them. For their novelty, of course. One of the basic functions of the brain is to separate information, because we're bombarded with information constantly, and the brain has to determine, what should you pay attention to and what should you not. Well, the novelty of these images, and novelty is one of the key factors that it uses. And, of course, these novels, this was like a bolt out of the blue, of course. Virtually nobody had imagined, conceived of such a thing. And then you combine that with the sheer awfulness, the immense emotions involved. These are going to be images which are going to be etched into memory.
Would it have been as powerful if we had just heard about them? For example, the Titanic went down, but nobody saw pictures of that. We saw pictures of the plane going into one of the towers.
That's right. Simply hearing about the event does not have – that has force, but it does not have the visceral force of an image. It's very important to realize – we need to step back and think about this. Our species has existed for about 200,000 years. The genus Homo has existed for about 2 million years. And in virtually all of that time, we lived in what we would describe as the Old Stone Age. We were nomadic hunter-gatherers, that sort of an environment. It was only 180 years ago that the first photographic image was taken. And now, of course, the world has changed immeasurably since then. So these images, we have brains which basically evolved in an environment in which, for example, there was no such thing as a photograph. There was no such thing as an image of something that was not that thing. And where are we now? We're living in a world in which we are, in fact, surrounded by such images. And so, of course, we don't respond to them necessarily rationally. There are processes within the brain that, they deal with them as we dealt with them in the Old Stone Age.
And you say those images go into the part of the brain that generates gut feelings and reactions rather than rational thoughts. Let's take a moment to tell everyone that I'm talking with Daniel Gardner, whose book, The Science of Fear, is published by Dutton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You say the brain is made up of two systems. System one, which processed the 9/11 images, is based on feeling and is very quick. System two is based on reason and works more slowly.
Yeah, this is a basic cognitive psychology. We tend to think, when we think about our minds and who we are and how we make decisions, we think that it's our conscious mind. It's the mind that's having this conversation. That's the mind, and it's the only mind that we have. That's actually an illusion. There is, in fact, an unconscious mind. And that unconscious mind, in fact, most of the work done by the brain actually happens below the level of consciousness. And that unconscious mind is extraordinarily important in our thoughts. And the way it works, the way these two minds interact, is that it's basically about speed is the essential feature. That the unconscious mind takes no effort. And it delivers instantaneous results. If I mention terrorism, you'll immediately have a certain feeling, a certain hunch. You know, if I say, what are the odds, you'll have a certain sense that this is true. Your unconscious mind is the source of, you know, these feelings, hunches, intuitions that you have. And then, of course, there's the second step, which is the conscious mind. And the big issue with the conscious mind, of course, is that it's a slow, lumbering beast.
Well, we could understand that if we are out in the savannah and we're hunting antelope with our conscious mind, and suddenly a lion appears, we want to have a very quick reaction and run as quickly as we can. Although I interviewed somebody not so long ago who said that when crises occur, people often just sit there and don't react. So, for example, we're told the plane is in serious trouble, we aren't mobilized. We sit there kind of stunned. I'm not sure whether we're waiting for the rational mind to kick in or not. But there are only some people who then take over.
That's true. That's in a crisis situation, which is a very particular sort of situation. But it's also very important. That raises a very interesting issue. One of the most popular myths about popular people's reactions to risks is this idea of panic, that if something bad happens, there will be panic. And in fact, the panic and chaos that ensues could deliver even worse damage than the terrible event itself. That's a myth. This has been studied widely and enormously, and it's very important to understand it. People don't react that way.
But it is also interesting to note, as you point out here, that there are things that are hardwired into us that are totally irrelevant to our lives. For example, people born in the Arctic, where there aren't any snakes, have an instinctive fear of them. I know somebody who cannot even look at a picture of a snake. If a snake comes on in a movie and it's not expected, she covers her eyes and asks people to tell her when the snake is gone. It's that powerful. She has this powerful phobia.
Absolutely. And, you know, look, that's because almost every ancestor this person had lived in an environment where being afraid of snakes was very important. And those who were afraid of snakes, they survived, and those that didn't.
But how have we been able to overcome our fear of wolves, because we keep dogs as pets and love them a lot?
Well, this is a very important thing to understand, is that we are not slaves to our intuitions. We're not slaves to any our hardwiring in any sense. For instance, even snakes, we have a tendency to be afraid of them. And that's how psychologists speak of it. But of course, it will not necessarily express itself as that. Some people keep snakes as pets. The point is that because that hardwiring is there, we are more likely to go in that direction than not.
For example, after 9/11, I went to Italy on vacation, and I was very pleased that so many people were not flying, because it was the first time I ever got to see Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel, the frescoes, without having to wait online. And there wasn't a big crowd in the room. And that was the case for so many things. I really had a terrific time.
That's exactly right. And listen, in writing the book, I was very conscious not to be preaching to the reader, because of course I'm human, I'm subject to all these things as well. But I will give the example of I have young children. And like every parent, I have this sense that, you know, the stranger abduction, that scenario, is a significant threat. The interesting thing is I've done the research. I did the research for the book. I know that is in fact a microscopic threat. An American child is actually 26 times more likely to die in a car crash than to be abducted by a stranger. But the amazing thing is I can't turn that off. I can't turn off that feeling, that hunch, that intuition that there's a serious threat there. But what I can do is I can bring my conscious mind to bear, and I can say, look, I know where this comes from. I know the psychological foibles that cause this, and I'm not going to allow myself to be controlled by them.
But so we are in some kind of a debate with ourselves.
Absolutely.
Because we still have those feelings whether we think we should have them or not.
We're in a debate with ourselves if we, in fact, bring our conscious minds to bear. One of the interesting findings, one of the most important findings of cognitive psychology, is that when we have a strong intuition that something is true, we do not question it. This is true even of educated, intelligent people who think that they are far too clever to be caught up by such things. When we have a strong intuition that something is true, we simply go with our gut. It is a habit that has to be developed, this idea that somehow, well, I think it's true, but let me examine it and ask myself if I really have evidence that it's true. That is a habit which we have to develop.
I want to go through them. You have a whole bunch of rules here that I want to run through that illustrate this. We'll do it after we take a little break. My guest is Daniel Gardner, who's a science writer and the author of The Science of Fear. Why We Fear the Things We Shouldn't and Put Ourselves in Greater Danger. The book is published by Dutton. We're back with Daniel Gardner, who's written a book called The Science of Fear, published by Dutton. And this is based on what cognitive scientists have been studying for years. Is fear one of the big issues out there in the science world?
Oh, certainly. There's a whole branch of psychology now which is devoted to risk perception. Why do we worry about some things and not worry about others? How do we decide this?
Well, let's look at some of the rules that you talk about, the anchoring rule. Can you tell us about it?
Well, the interesting question is, how does the unconscious mind come up with these snap judgments if, in fact, you know, it takes the conscious mind so much time to do the same thing? Well, it does that because it doesn't survey all the information available to it and then think about it logically. It uses what psychologists call heuristics and biases. A bias is obvious, that's a tendency, and a heuristic is simply a rule of thumb. The anchoring rule is very simple. Basically, if I ask you to estimate a number, it could be a number of anything, you know, how many tomato soup cans do you want to buy from this stand? What you will unconsciously do is you will reach for the nearest number available to you, and then you will adjust accordingly. If it's a very low number, you'll adjust up. If it's a very high number, you'll adjust down. And what's interesting is...
And if you mention a number, won't I automatically focus on that one?
The astonishing thing about this is if I ask you to take out your driver's license and look at the last three digits of your driver's license and then ask you to estimate how many tomato soup cans you want, that the fact that you looked at your driver's license will influence your decision.
Can someone who's aware of our brain's tendency to follow the anchoring rule ignore the irrelevant information?
No. That's the very interesting thing. Psychologists have great fun with this one, as you can imagine. In fact, they've done lots of experiments in which they've said, here is the anchoring rule. Here is how it works. Here is how it will influence you. Don't let it influence you.
Look at your license number.
And then they say, go ahead and do this, and it influences them.
Aren't our gut feelings also ruled by something called the rule of typical things?
Yeah, I call it the rule of typical things in the book. It's the representativeness heuristic is the proper term. You can see why I changed the name because it's terribly forgettable. It's a very simple thing. It simply says this. If you're to judge, imagine you're going to judge a scenario. How likely is, well, I'll give you an actual psychological test. How likely is it that in the next year there will be a flood in North America that will kill 1,000 people? Well, you'll make an estimate. Or if I ask you, imagine this. How likely is it that there will be an earthquake in California that will spark a flood that will kill 1,000 people? Clearly, logically, the second scenario has to be less likely than the first scenario. You won't judge it that way. In fact, you'll judge the second scenario to be more likely than the first scenario. And the reason for that is nothing says California like earthquake. It's a stereotype. There's an element in there that sounds typical, that fits the stereotype, and your unconscious mind will use that and say, aha, that fits.
And this also ties in with some of our more bigoted thoughts, doesn't it?
Oh, that's exactly right. I mean, this is in essence, you know, what constitutes a typical thing? It could be almost anything. Partly it's going to be informed by your culture. If your culture says, what's a typical criminal? Well, that's a young black man. That is going to be operating in your unconscious mind. You may even be unaware of it. You may even be opposed to that sort of bigotry, but it will still operate.
And now we're seeing that with Muslims, Jews in the past, Asians for a while in this country. Mm-hmm. Well, how does this work on an evolutionary level? What did the rule of typical things do for our prehistoric ancestors?
Well, again, it goes back to the value of a snap judgment. And as you say, if you're walking across the plains of Africa, you know, and you see something move in the long grass, you have to react instantly. You don't have a lot of time to think about it. The nice thing about something like this, the value of a stereotype is, you know, how often have you seen a lion snack on your fellow band member? That's sort of typical lion behavior. Okay, well, you don't need to think for a long time as to whether you should be afraid of lions.
Aren't stories best understood by the side of our brain that deal with gut feelings? You say,
yeah.
Gut is a sucker for a good story.
This is an absolutely essential feature, and it's also particularly important for understanding why the media does what it does. We are hardwired for storytelling, both the telling of stories and listening to stories. Evolutionary psychologists say that this is hardwiring. It's universal. And what constitutes a good story doesn't change, whether you're talking about the evening news or you're talking about a Hollywood movie or a novel or Shakespeare or the Bible. It's always the same thing. It's identifiable people. It's something novel. It's something different. It's got emotions, drama, conflict. And the more it's got those elements, the better the story is. And we really respond to those things intuitively. The interesting and unfortunate part is we have no similar intuitive wiring for numbers. Numbers have no emotional content. Numbers don't move us. We have no intuitive understanding of them. So if we don't, in fact, develop our numerical skills, we actually will be innumerate.
And this is something that politicians learn to understand. If they're really good at numbers and can explain why, how to get out of a recession, they're less likely to reach voters than if they tell a good story.
That's exactly right. Why do politicians stand up and talk about Mrs. Mary Smith who can't afford health insurance in Peoria or whatever? It's, you know, because it's one person. There are 300 million Americans. Logically, this is not the way you should go about it. You should start firing off statistics. No, it's because they understand to communicate and move people, to really connect with them, you tell stories. Don't use numbers.
And that leads us to the example rule.
The example rule is one of the most important of the rules used by the unconscious minds to determine probability. It's simply this. How hard is it for me to think of an example of something? If it's easy, if that example comes to me quickly, that thing must be common and therefore likely to happen again in the future. And of course, if you have to struggle to think of an example, it must be uncommon and therefore unlikely to happen again in the future. Now, if you think about that, that made perfect sense in the Stone Age because the only information available to you was your personal experience or the experience of your fellow band members. So if you could easily think of a crocodile dragging somebody to his death at the watering hole, you should be afraid of crocodiles. But the problem is, of course, the information environment has radically changed. You sit down, you turn on the evening news, and what do you see? And I'll give you a real news story. You see the story of a 9-year-old German boy who was lured to his death by a pedophile. Now, your conscious mind understands that this one tragic story in Germany tells you nothing about the safety of your children here in the United States. That's not how the unconscious mind processes that information. It says to itself, how easy is it for me to think of an example of this? It really easy. I just saw it last night in the news. It's so vivid and emotional. It's burned into my memory.
And the same thing could happen if I worked in a skyscraper in Omaha, Nebraska, and thought about the 9/11 attacks.
Exactly right. How easy is it for you to think of an example of terrorism? Astonishingly easy. All these years after 9/11.
So emotions with a memory with an emotional content will stick a lot better than a memory that doesn't have an emotional content, and that plays into this as well.
See, all these things are connected. You know, we talked about stories have intuitive meaning and numbers don't. If I cite a bunch of statistics now, which I could, they're much less likely to affix themselves in your memory. The stories, that's powerful, it's emotional, and that emotional content affixes it in memory, and then it's available to influence these other cognitive mechanisms.
But sometimes the memories aren't even legitimate. Many people point out, movie buffs especially, that Ronald Reagan sometimes recalled having experienced something that actually took place in a movie. So imagined examples are as effective as real things?
That's exactly right. In fact, psychologists have shown that when people are asked to imagine an event happening and then they're asked to estimate the probability of it happening, in fact, their estimate of the probability goes up. The act of imagining is powerful, which is why lotteries, for example, lotteries and casinos like you to think about winning, because, of course, that influences your intuitive sense of how likely is it am I going to win?
Even though my rational brain tells me that it's very unlikely
exactly.
that I'm going to win the lottery.
Exactly.
Daniel Gardner's book is The Science of Fear. It is published by Dutton. There's another rule that I'd like to talk about, the good-bad rule.
Yeah, the good-bad rule is this simply refers to emotion. One of the most interesting findings, compelling findings out of cognitive psychology over the last 10, 20 years, even 30 years, is the influence of emotion. What psychologists have discovered is, now when I talk about emotion, people think about fear and anger, these very overt emotions, the things that when you experience them, you know you experience them. Emotion's much subtler than that. We constantly experience emotion in response to stimuli. In fact, it can be so subtle that we can experience emotion unconsciously and we have no conscious awareness of it at all.
So haven't researchers discovered that people had a strong unconscious negative reaction to black uniforms with sports teams?
Exactly.
But there are hockey and football players who wear black uniforms, and it's been pointed out that they are likely to get more penalties from referees than teams that are wearing other colors. Still, many teams persist. Should the Oakland Raiders stop wearing black? Pittsburgh Pirates?
Well, another element of that same sort of emotional package is aggressiveness. If you want your players to be aggressive, in fact, wearing black uniforms influences them on that side. So there might be a trade-off, which might explain why they continue to do it.
But why black uniforms?
Because that's part of the stereotype. That's what black means in the culture. You know, a black clothing is powerful. That's what this image means. It could mean different things in different cultures, but that's where it is. But the point is that what the unconscious mind does in terms of risk perception is it takes these constant emotional reactions that we're having, whether we're aware of them or not, and it uses them as a yardstick, and it says, good thing. Well, good things don't kill you. And so naturally, it's your risk. What that does is it drives your risk perception down. Conversely, if you have a bad emotional reaction to something, you say, okay, bad things do kill you. That drives risk perception up. The consequences of that are many. But one of them, just to give you one example, cigarettes in corner stores. You know, the corner store, the neighborhood convenience store where everyone's gone and children go to get candy. Why do you think the tobacco companies want to put their cigarette packages on the power wall on display behind what? The candy, where children are brought in and they're, you know, given the ultimate treat. And we all have good feelings for the corner store. It's because they're developing positive associations. You're developing a positive association. You're developing an emotional reaction to the brands and to the images. And that emotional reaction can subsequently influence your behavior, including your risk perception.
It's more powerful than being told that if we smoke, we heighten the risk of getting lung cancer?
When a doctor sits down and tells you, look, if you continue to do this, it's going to kill you, your conscious mind gets that. That's pretty clear. Not your unconscious mind. Again, it doesn't understand statistics. It's not moved by statistics. And here's another element that the unconscious mind uses to determine risk perception. This is one of the very most important ones. Familiarity. Something that's novel, strange, unusual, that drives risk perception up. The more familiar it is, the more it drives risk perception down. Well, if you're a regular smoker, day after day after day, you've smoked, week after week, month after month, and nothing bad happened. Guess what your unconscious mind is telling you? There's no concern here. Don't worry about it. Chain smokers, very often, you'll see them, psychologists call this process habituation. Very often, they'll stand there with a cigarette in their fingers, and they won't even be consciously aware that the cigarette is there. That's because their brain is saying no threat, no reason to draw conscious attention to it.
Is this because we find the idea of randomness especially difficult to comprehend?
Randomness is another one of these elements that coming out of, you know, our innumeracy.
Not everybody gets cancer from smoking.
Oh, right. No, exactly. And it's very easy to rationalize, right? Because, you know, everybody knows the 193-year-old who didn't get cancer from smoking. And so, well, if he can do it, so can I. Well, that's the same as, you know, looking at a lottery winner and saying, therefore, I can win the lottery. Conversely, it flips the other way. If something extremely rare and tragic happens to somebody else, looking at that one case and saying, therefore, this threat is real and I should treat it as if it were significant, it's just as irrational.
We're social animals. Are our brains hardwired to conform to the ideas held by the group that we happen to be with?
Absolutely. We want to cooperate. If you think back to that evolutionary environment again, you know, if you were living in a band of mavericks and malcontents and proud nonconformists, you'd not last terribly long. You have to work together to survive. And to work together, cooperation and agreement is essential. And so what social psychologists have shown is that we have very strong sense to agree. We have a strong desire to agree with others. So if the people around you are convinced that something is a threat or that some other thing is not a threat and that it's foolish to pay any attention to it, that's an extremely important influence on your judgment.
I loved your statement about confirmation bias, meaning that the blind can lead the blind indefinitely.
Confirmation bias is one of the most pernicious biases in the human brain. It is simply this, and it operates in all human brains. Very important to emphasize this. It's simply this. If once you believe something, you will uncritically accept information that supports that belief. Conversely, you will ignore or belittle or be very skeptical of information that disputes that belief. And as a result, you can continue to pile up information, and you can support the most outlandish beliefs this way.
But it also leads to distortion of information. You tell the story of the Alabama Free Militia in comparison to a Muslim group and how they were not reported on equally, and I would assume that's because one confirms something, a prejudice we already had.
One of the most important things to understand about media behavior is that reporters are human. I know this sounds a little trite, but reporters are human, and hence...
It's the first time anybody's ever called me human.
Hence these heuristics and biases, these psychological foibles operate in the media. And one of the ways they operate is confirmation bias finds expression in the form of narratives. The media establish a narrative, and then they go out to confirm the narrative while ignoring information that's contrary to it. So after the Oklahoma City bombing, what was the narrative on terrorism? It was angry white men. And that lasted for a number of years until 9/11. And then, of course, the media narrative changed. Well, there was a suicide bomber in 2005. A suicide bomber actually blew himself up outside a packed football stadium in Oklahoma, and it went virtually unreported. Why? Because he was an angry white man, and that fit the old media narrative, but not the new one.
Then we needed a Muslim blowing himself up in this case.
If his name had been Muhammad, it would have been international news.
You also discuss hindsight bias, which is like confirmation bias.
Hindsight bias is tricky, and it's one of the reasons it helps explain why people tend to be nostalgic about the past and why we tend to be fearful of the future, or at least we tend to
things
think
were
that
safer when we were younger. I left my door open. I never had to lock my door.
Right.
Now I do.
Which you know, in some cases may be objectively true, but in some cases it may just be a psychological perception. See, if you stand and you look at the future, what do you see? It's all uncertain, right? It's all a black void. And of course, uncertainty is frightening. But then if you look backwards, what happens? Oh, no, no, you know how that movie ended. The uncertainty is drained out of it. And the very interesting thing about hindsight bias is, if I said to you now, how likely is it that John McCain will be elected president in November? You give me a number. I can come back to you in 6 months and say, think back to prior to the election. How likely did you think it was that John McCain would be elected president? You will give me a different number. It will be a higher or lower number depending upon the actual result. The point is that our brains twist our perceptions to match what we already know.
It's also ironic that we seem to be growing more fearful at a time when we're living longer and we're healthier than ever before. In fact, life expectancy for people born in the United States now is almost 78%, up from 78 years. It's up from 59 in 1930. Yet we think that things were better in the past.
This is one of the most astonishing aspects to me. I'm a bit of a pessimist by nature, but when I look at the facts, when I look at the most basic facts, which is child mortality rates, life expectancy, we've seen improvements unlike anything in human history over the last 100 years. 100 years ago in the United States, the child mortality rate was almost 1 in 5. Think about that. Almost 1 in 5 American children died before the age of 5. Today, that figure is now down below 1%. We should be immensely grateful that we are alive today.
A lot of people who would have died from illnesses now saved by medical treatments. The world is a lot safer today, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
Although you do point out that when we drive to the airport, we're really putting our lives in a lot more risk than when we fly. That's because I guess you don't fly U.S. Air very much. I fear that we have pretty much run out of time. Daniel Gardner, what are you going to do next? Is there another emotion that you're going to investigate in the next book?
Well, you know, it's the application. It's more the application of psychology to practical problems. You know, and one of the things that interests me now is the psychology of politics. I find this stuff fascinating.
The Science of Fear: Why We Fear the Things We Shouldn't. We should be fearing politicians, I guess, and put ourselves in greater danger. Is published by Dutton, and it is It has been a great pleasure to talk with Daniel Gardner today. Thank you so much for being on our show.
And thank you.
On tomorrow's show, Randy Newman live, playing selections from Harps and Angels, his first album of new music in 9 years. And then Elliot Gould chats about why Time magazine described him as a star for an uptight age. Plus, Sadia Shepherd traces her past to a tiny Jewish community in India. And on Underreported, Judge Juan Guzman, once a supporter of General Pinochet's government, and how his views changed after he was appointed to prosecute Chile's deposed leader. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Stephen Valentino, Tanya Vita King, Lawrence Holland, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.